Welcome to the Aporia podcast. Remember, you can listen to this podcast on all the major platforms. If you like the show, you'll love the Aporia magazine. Find the link in the show notes, along with our Twitter and a link to the bonus questions we ask our guests.
Hi, I'm Beau Weingard, and this is the Aporia podcast. And today I am joined by my prestigious, dare I say, colleague, Noah Carl, and we are going to continue our discussion on free speech, this time focusing more on free speech on the internet, I suppose would be the theme, and just ask the major question, which is, what is your attitude about censorship or regulation of speech on enormous social media platforms such as Twitter?
Yeah, so I'm against the right of those social media platforms to ban people and censor people, except under very specific conditions. For example, I don't think Twitter should have been able to ban Donald Trump. When was it? 20?
Yeah, after the 2020 election. After the January 6th.
Yeah. Which means I'm in favor of government interference in the social media marketplace, and in particular, in favor of governments telling big tech firms you cannot ban this or that person except under very specific conditions.
So before I attempt to forward my arguments against that, to be clear or to clarify, would you support this kind of government intervention only for firms that are a certain size?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Okay, so for example, if the National Review wants to curate its comment section, presumably you would claim that that's okay?
Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't pass any laws demanding that magazines or newspapers not be able to curate their comment sections.
Okay. So it seems to me that one might have a problem right here pretty quickly, because what about something as large as the New York Times? What's the distinction between, say, the New York Times comment section and Twitter?
I think there's several key differences. For example, if you want to get elected in a Western country, particularly the US, and if you want to reach young people, you basically have to be on Twitter if you're not already well known, and arguably on certain other social media platforms as well, maybe Facebook. If you're already well known, if you're a major businessman like Trump, or you're from a political dynasty like the Clintons, you probably don't need to be on Twitter, although it would help. But if you are an up-and-comer, in order to reach a large audience of particularly young people who are more likely to use social media, you need to be on there. So it's anti-democratic for the social media platforms to be able to ban particularly politicians, but of course anyone participating in political discourse also. By contrast, the New York Times comment section, a lot of people read it, maybe in the hundreds of thousands or millions, at least over a month or a year. But it's regulating that is not going to interfere in the democratic process in any significant way. And in the second difference, which probably could have come first, is that just the numbers are far larger on Twitter and Facebook. I don't know, maybe several million people read the New York Times comment section a year. On Twitter, obviously, has hundreds of millions of users. So it's a different order of magnitude. And usually the New York Times comment section is concerned, has a debate related to the particular article in question rather than a general debate. So I think that's also relevant.
So suppose that I think those are important and fair distinctions, and essentially it would be about power and influence, right? That Twitter has so much power and influence that suppressing or censoring speech on Twitter is much more damaging to public discourse than is, say, removing a comment.
Yeah. I mean, as I will explain now or in response to a future question, that Twitter and Facebook, especially with regard to politics, are basically the public square.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the public square is publicly owned by definition, so the government can't ban people from there. But if the government, if the town square was privatized, and then the company said we only allow liberals and leftists here, conservatives aren't allowed to make their arguments in the town square. Obviously, that would be wrong, but it would also be far less consequential than banning them from Twitter, because the town square nowadays is far larger. It's at the national or the international level,
right?
And speech that happens on social media is often far more important, invariably far more important than speech that happens in a town square or an equivalent location somewhere else in a country.
So, assume that I start a competitor to Twitter, and my brand is that this is going to be a place for pleasant discourse. Any kind of insults, any kinds of negativity will be removed. And if you violate the rules that our company has written multiple times, then you'll be kicked off. In your view, that would only be subject to government intervention, the government coming in and telling me or forcing me as a business owner not to enforce my rules. Only after I've reached a certain amount of influence.
I think so, yeah.
Okay. So here's my question on the even on the Twitter one. So would you apply, I don't want to get too legalistic here, but would you apply essentially First Amendment principles, American First Amendment principles, to this policy that you would recommend?
Is that, by that do you mean you can say anything on Twitter that you can say?
Yes.
In the public square?
Yes.
Yeah, I would. Yeah.
Okay.
So that means you can't say certain things without being stopped. Like, you can't call for an individual to be murdered.
Right.
You can't incite violence against a group.
Right.
You can't, I don't know, sell. You can't reveal the US's nuclear codes, things like that.
Yes, but you can say things that would be considered egregiously obnoxious, perhaps yeah, even hateful.
You can call people the N-word.
Yeah, exactly. So. you can use racial epithets. You can call women the C-word, etc.
Yeah, you can deny the Holocaust.
Okay. So what I think is important. So I have a couple of objections to this to your recommendations. So I'd like to pursue these. So the first is, and maybe this is the simplest to address, but it is a legitimate concern, and I'm not at all a libertarian. However, it does disconcert me to give the government the power to tell a private company, you have to do X, Y, or Z, or you can't do X, Y, or Z, even though it might be better for your business model.
Yeah, so the response to that is that, generally speaking, government interference is unwise, except where there's some kind of market failure. It's a sort of standard principle that most people in the center-left and the center-right and other parts of the political landscape can accept. But social media is often a natural monopoly, and that's a type of market failure. Well, it's not that anything has failed in the literal meaning of that term. It's just that it's really hard to make a viable competitor to Twitter. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean a competitor that has anywhere close to the same number of users and in which the discourse is anywhere close to as important. I looked up the numbers, and I think if you take all the microblogging sites in the US, Twitter accounts for something like 80-90%
mm-hmm.
of the users.
Mm-hmm.
So you got Twitter, and then you have, you know, a few other places that people with certain more specific interests, maybe people who are more concerned about politeness and or, you know, they have you know, all their conservatives and right wing activists that have been booted off Twitter.
Right.
But basically, the nature of a social network like Twitter or X, as I suppose we should call it.
Yes. Yes.
Is that the benefit you get from it, generally speaking, increases the more other people are using it.
Right.
So this leads in equilibrium, as the economists would say, to almost everyone being on one platform.
Right.
It's not like, market for hamburgers where...
To listen to the full podcast, become a subscriber at aporiamagazine.com.